Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, March 8, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we will hear a telephone discussion of the Supreme Court case, Impression Products versus Lexmark International, and about the law of patent exhaustion. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Professor Adam Mossoff, co-founder and director of academic programs and senior scholar at the Center for the Protection of Intellectual Property. He is also a professor at the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University. We are also happy to have Professor David Olson, Associate Professor at Boston College Law School, and Mr. Stephen Tepp, President and CEO of Sentinel Worldwide and Professorial Lecturer in Law at George Washington University Law School, and our moderator, Professor Ozinga, who is a Professor of Law at University of Richmond. I'll turn it over to Professor Ozinga to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Kristen. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Laura. I am going to briefly introduce the case, the Lexmark case, but very briefly because I want to spend the most of the time letting the experts on the panel discuss it. So the issue in the Lexmark case is printer cartridges. So Lexmark makes printer cartridges, sells them under two different ways. You can either buy them at full price and unrestricted, or you can buy them in return for an agreement where you can use the cartridge only once and then return it for recycling or reuse. And these are the ones that are the biggest concern in this case. So Impression Products and a number of other defendants buy up these used toner cartridges and then refill them and resell them. And so Lexmark sued Impression Products and a number of other defendants asserting that the defendants infringed certain patents, either by acquiring, refilling, and selling these used cartridges that were bought under the agreement to only use once and return to Lexmark in violation of their post-sale restriction, or acquiring, refilling, and selling regular cartridges, the ones not bought under the return program. But these were first sold outside the United States. So Impression Products moved for dismissal. It was heard at the district court. The district court ruled that the acquisition and sale of the cartridges sold in the United States did not infringe the patent rights, that the first sale doctrine did not apply to patented articles purchased abroad, despite the Kurtzeng decision, which the experts will talk about, and that the acquisition and sale of those first sold abroad constituted infringement. So both rulings were appealed in the Federal Circuit in a rather unusual move. Sua sponte ordered en banc consideration, looking at the case in view of two of their precedent cases, Mallinckrodt versus Medipart and Jazz Photo. The Federal Circuit en banc sided with Lexmark on both issues, and the case now is on appeal to the Supreme Court. So the questions before the Supreme Court, the questions presented are thus. Does a conditional sale that transfers title with post-sale restrictions on the use or resale of the item avoid patent exhaustion doctrine and therefore permits the enforcement of post-sale restrictions by suing for patent infringement? And the second question, in light of the Kurtzing case of the Supreme Court, which held that copyrighted works lawfully made abroad are subject to the same post-sale restrictions as work made domestically, the question is, does a sale of a patented article abroad exhaust the United States patent rights in that article? So I don't want to take anything away from our fantastic experts. I'm going to turn it over first to David Olson. He will be followed by Adam Mossoff. And finally, last but not least, Stephen Tepp. Go ahead, David.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here and to participate in this call. It's a very interesting case and one that could really determine a lot of commercial activity in the U.S. and around the world. On the other hand, the court might dodge some of the bigger issues the way it did in the last patent exhaustion case of Quanta. So what I'm going to do is kind of go through the history of the case law here and kind of talk about how the case might come out based on that history, and also make a couple of kind of economic points about the potential outcomes from the holdings. So as Kristen said, in Lexmark, we've got two real categories that we're dealing with. One, whether selling cartridges in the U.S., patented cartridges, with restrictions on the use, basically may not reuse, may not transfer to anyone else, can only return them to Lexmark, whether that's legitimate, as opposed to selling another cartridge for a higher price where the consumers have full rights to resell and reuse, et cetera. So there's that issue, and then there's the international exhaustion issue. If Lexmark sells cartridges overseas, regular return program cartridges, whatever, may they then be re-imported into the U.S.? And I'm going to kind of take those in turn. The effect, if the court holds that there is exhaustion and also holds that overseas sales could then be re-imported into the U.S., would really affect the business model of a number of patent owners who currently engage in both price discrimination to sell products at various price points to people who are willing to pay more and people who are willing to pay less, and who also have different patent rights in different countries, which may not give them the same rights in those countries as the U.S., and if their sales overseas were then subject to exhaustion, might really restrict the amount of sales they make overseas or change their pricing strategies, therefore. So this is quite an important commercial case, and although it turns on some arcane patent law and copyright law issues, the effects are going to be, or potentially at least, are quite substantial. So the last time the Supreme Court talked about patent exhaustion was 2008 with the case of Quanta Computer versus LG Electronics. In that case, LG Electronics had system and method patents covering computer chips, both in their combinations with other computer components and use in computers. So LG licensed this technology to Intel, which makes chips, computer chips. It made chips and then resold those to others who would incorporate the chips into their machines, as we've all seen the commercials that say Intel inside. The license agreement between LG and Intel explicitly did not license third parties to practice the patents, and also required Intel to inform consumers or Intel's customers accordingly. So the contract said that nevertheless, exhaustion applied as it normally would. So it was a bit of a confusing contract, and it did not make an explicit field of use restriction, as in these may only be used to, these patents are only licensed to make a chip and it can't be combined with something else, or these patents are only licensed to make chips that are combined with other LGE components. It didn't do that. It kind of stopped short. So what happened? Intel sold chips. Quanta Computer combined these with non-LGE components. And LG then sued Quanta Computer. The Supreme Court said that Quanta Computer was okay because exhaustion applies. And the court really looked specifically at the contract and based a lot of its reasoning on the contract, which is why the holding's rather narrow. So the contract authorized Intel to sell the products that practiced the patents, but did not limit Intel's authority to resell or to sell those chips. So the court said because there was no explicit limit on Intel's right to resell, there's exhaustion. Intel's right to resell without any restriction whatsoever means that the patent right has been exhausted. The question that remained after Intel, after the Quanta Computer, case, is whether one could, with better contract law and field of use restrictions, whether one could contract around patent exhaustion or whether Quanta is going to have a broad holding which says, much like the Kurtzing case that Steve Tepp's going to talk about, that says that once you've sold something and kind of gotten your money for that first sale, there's not going to be a right to further restrict downstream use. What LG wanted to do in the Quanta case, just to be clear, was it wanted to sell or license Intel. Intel would make the chips, and then for downstream producers who would combine those chips with the computer, it wanted those producers to have to come back to LGE and license the use of those patents. And by doing this, it could come up with quite a sophisticated kind of price discrimination system where different uses would be charged different amounts. And this could be either, depending on your outlook, this could either be almost abusive of the patent right, or on the other hand, it could be quite a sophisticated way to allow uses that are both very valuable, and therefore that LG could extract more money for the use of the patent, and also uses that are rather less valuable, but that nevertheless, if LGE can price discriminate, it would be happy to authorize. So the outcome here meant that, that LGE could not do that. So this is the background. Then we get the Lexmark case. And the Lexmark case at the Federal Circuit goes back to some prior Federal Circuit precedent, as well as some prior Supreme Court precedent to say that patent exhaustion should not apply in the Lexmark case. So a couple of pieces of precedent. First, the Federal Circuit in the Mallinckrodt, its prior precedent there, broadly said that that field of use kind of restrictions should apply, and that patent exhaustion does not take place just from a first authorized sale. In Jazz Photo versus ITC, the Federal Circuit said that an authorized sale abroad does not give right to rise to a importation and use right in the U.S. So these are kind of the two underlying Federal Circuit cases. And the Federal Circuit also looked at the 1938 Supreme Court case of General Talking Pictures. In that case, the court said that field of use limitations on the scope of patent licenses were okay and upheld them with respect to the sale of amplifiers that were restricted to non-commercial use. So in that case, if someone resold an amplifier that had been sold for non-commercial use, resold it to someone who was going to make commercial use of it, the Supreme Court said that is a violation of the patent right because no patent license for that commercial field of use had been given. So the Federal Circuit really focused on that language and also on the text of the patent statute, Section 271 of the statute, which says that which gives the right let me just give you the language. Except as otherwise provided in this title, whoever without authority makes, uses, offers to sell, or sells any patented invention within the United States or imports into the United States any patented invention during the term of the patent infringes the patent. So what the Federal Circuit said was that this text means there has to be an explicit authorization to do any of those things like make, use, or sell, or import. And without that explicit permission, it's a violation of the patent right to import. The Federal Circuit also said that differing from copyright law kind of applies worldwide, whereas patent law is country by country, and therefore a sale in Germany, let's say, doesn't implicate those same, you know, there may or may not be a patent in Germany, doesn't implicate those same rights as in the U.S. So that was an important thing that the court focused on, and the court also focused on the difference between copyright and patent law in that the copyright statute explicitly has a first sale provision and explicitly says that first sale provision affects the right to distribute copyrights. Patent law has no statutory first sale provision or exhaustion provision. It's all been read into the law by courts, and therefore there's certainly a strong argument that that should be much more limited. I see that I'm really up against the time that I'm supposed to have talked for now, so I'm going to stop there and let Steve Tepp talk about the Kurtzsang kind of angle on this, and maybe we'll talk more about the international exhaustion in the Q&A. Thank you.
Thank you, David. I think I'm supposed to go next, right, Kristen?
Yes, I was turning it over to you, Adam.
Okay, great. Thank you. So it's great to be speaking about this case, and now for something a little different, to paraphrase a classic piece of creative works that most people know and love. I filed an amicus brief in support of Lexmark a couple weeks ago, and David very helpfully set up the kind of background context of the immediate case law that we're working within in the commercialization issues. And my amicus brief addressed kind of a higher level or conceptual level point about the nature of what we now call exhaustion doctrine today and what was really just known as conveyance or licenses and assignment doctrines in the 19th century. And that is that it has long been the case in the United States since the very first Patent Act of 1790 and up through court decisions through the 19th century and 20th century that patents are, in fact, property rights. And so the transfer of these property rights in the marketplace and the commercialization of them between market actors is not just an issue of contract. It's an issue of a conveyance of a property interest. And for all people who have gone through law school know, in your 1L year, you spend a lot of time studying property conveyances and the ways in which property is conveyed by owners to other people with various restrictive conditions and lesser estates and things of that sort. And unsurprisingly, because patents were defined by courts as in the 19th century as property rights, on par with and with repeated references to common law real estate cases and defined in the same terms, the 19th century courts, as David just said, you know, this is not from the statute, this is from court judgment law, applied real estate concepts and doctrines to patents, not just globally, but also in particular areas such as in the conveyance context. And in fact, we know this because the very nature of the designation of how a patent owner conveys their interests through either an assignment or a license, both of those concepts, assignments and licenses, are not contract terms. They are common law real estate terms for the transfer of property interests. An assignment is a transfer of your entire interest in property, and a license is a transfer of a mere interest, of which it doesn't give you a title in the estate or in the property, and therefore one cannot, for instance, sue on it and things of that sort that we all know very well in the patent law context. And thus, in the 19th century, when patent owners embracing the property rights definition of patented innovation went into the market and started transferring their interest to manufacturers and to other commercial actors and not manufacturing themselves and entering into agreements. And when these agreements ended up in court through a dispute, they were challenged as being invalid at the time. And the courts repeatedly and consistently said, this is a transfer of property interest and you have the ability to either assign your interest or license your interest and impose conditions and other types of things of that sort. And you can even create all sorts of different types of property estate type interests in owners. So they referred to, for instance, multiple owners of patents, so people who were multiple assignees with geographic restrictions between them as tenants in common. They referred to patent owners who passed on restricted conditions in their patented property, whether it was through a field of use restriction, as David described, or geographic restraint or other. They referred to the patent owner as retaining a reversionary interest, and so on and so on. And this application, therefore, of real estate conveyance doctrines in the patent space, in the commercialization of new technology, meant that they also applied the general default rule that exists for transfer of property interests in land and other types of assets, which is that if you transfer something outright, you lose all your interest in it. Your property rights are exhausted because you transferred them to someone else in totality. But if you impose restrictive conditions through express language, so instead of saying, you know, I give Blackacre to A and her heirs, or I say I give Blackacre to A for life, or to A so long as she doesn't use it in another context, that explicit language, as long as it's recorded in a deed and provides notice to people, especially to third parties, is a restriction that runs with the interest to all successors and assigns. And in fact, that's exactly how that language was written. I've read far too many conveyance interests of assignments and licenses of patent rights in the 19th century, and I can attest that they consistently, repeatedly use this language in terms of they transfer to successors and assigns, the interest in the patent or a certain percentage of it or whatnot, with a whole variety of restricted conditions sometimes. And in fact, many American patent owners were innovators in embracing the commercialization of property rights and new technological innovation by doing things like not manufacturing and simply licensing their interests and assigning them to other people to do this in a lot of variety of contexts. So for instance, Charles Goodyear, and a lot venture of vulcanized rubber, did not actually create the Goodyear Tire Company that was formed about four decades after he died. He actually solely assigned and licensed his interest to other people because he was just a crazy inventor and wanted to invent. Similarly, Elias Howe, the inventor of the lock stitch, and even Thomas Edison in his initial early inventing career, and Nikola Tesla, and many, many, many others never manufactured their actual inventions. At times, they actually transferred them with these various restricted conditions that flowed through downstream transactions to the purchasers and successive users of the property interest so long as the interest was explicitly provided in writing in a recorded instrument and follow-on people had notice, either actual or constructive, per the very terms that we understand from real estate transactions. And this, and so this very doctrinal framework in which patent owners today engage in these extremely complex commercial transactions and creating incredibly impressive supply chains and distribution chains along the whole value chain, in where you get from invention all the way to consumer product, such as our amazing smartphones and amazing drugs and things of that sort, is predicated upon not a contract foundation, but in fact a property rights foundation, which is exactly what you would expect. It's the nature and structure of the very doctrine in which they're embracing, and it is one that the Supreme Court should, in Impression Products v. Lexmark, affirm as being something consistent with over 200 years of American jurisprudence with respect to the treatment of patents as property rights. So, thank you.
Thank you, Adam. Let me turn it on over now to Steve.
Thanks very much. Thanks to the Federalist Society for having me. I'm honored to participate. And let me just say my remarks today are my own and do not necessarily reflect the views of any client or employer. So, David already mentioned in passing the Kurtzang case, which was a 2013 Supreme Court case in which the court conclusively ruled on the issue of international exhaustion of the copyright distribution right. I'm going to briefly describe that case and then try and relate it back to how it affects, or not, the case that we're talking about today. So Supap Kurtzang, a citizen of Thailand, came to the United States to attend Cornell University. And he had the entrepreneurial idea to have his family buy up textbooks that were sold at the universities in Thailand, send them to him and here in the United States, and he resold them. Now, as you might imagine, the price that those textbooks could fetch in Thailand was considerably lower than it is here in the United States, and so Kurtzang was effectively arbitraging the price differential and made quite a bit of money. He also attracted a lawsuit from Wiley & Sons Publishing, claiming that he was violating the exclusive right of importation as Congress created in Section 602 of the Copyright Act. That right has been interpreted because of language in the statute and because of a prior Supreme Court case to be a subset of the distribution right, and the distribution right in copyright is subject to what's known as the first sale doctrine. And here's where it's important to quickly note that the history and meaning of the first sale doctrine in patent and copyright have diverged significantly. As you've heard in the patent context, the first sale doctrine means just that. A transfer of ownership has taken place. In copyright, that's how it began, and it was in fact codified in the 1909 Copyright Act as a first sale. However, when Congress rewrote that doctrine in the 1976 Copyright Act, which remains in force today, it made no reference at all to first sale. Instead, the test is whether a given copy was, quote, lawfully made under this title, unquote. And that was the heart of the legal question in Kurtzang. Are copies made outside the United States with the permission of the copyright owner lawfully made under this title? Which, of course, became a question of territoriality. Does this title apply outside the United States? The first sale doctrine... Sorry, I lost my chain of thought. So if copies abroad trigger the first sale doctrine, it essentially eliminates the importation right, because then the creation of it abroad means it's a lawfully made copy, and therefore the first sale doctrine limits the importation right before it's ever exercised. On the other hand, if copies made abroad were not lawfully made under this title, that's a designation that can never change. So those copies would be endowed with an inexhaustible distribution right. And the court was really faced with this choice between giving effect to one provision of the statute or another, but it couldn't really faithfully give effect to both. In terms of the policy arguments, as you would expect, Wiley and Sons made the case that differential pricing is beneficial to people in countries with a lower standard of living, and that if they don't have the ability to engage in differential pricing, then it's going to actually harm the people in Thailand and in other markets where they would otherwise sell for a lower price because they're not going to be willing to do so, or at least not as much, because of the ability of people to bring that product back into the United States or other markets with higher price versions of it. Kurt Seng and his amici imagined a parade of horribles. Copies not subject to exhaustion of the distribution right would mean the end of used bookstores, the end of libraries, and so on and so forth. Now, I'll interject here my own personal view that that argument put hyperbole over empirical data, because for a good 20 years prior to the Supreme Court's decision in Kurt Seng, it was widely accepted the first sale doctrine did not apply to works made abroad, and we simply didn't see anything like that parade of horribles. Nonetheless, the court was unwilling to contemplate an inexhaustible distribution right and ruled for Kurt Seng. So how does this apply to Impression Products versus Lexmark, and what does it tell us about what the court may or may not say this term? Considering the differences between the Copyright Act and patent jurisprudence, one might think there's very little the Kurt Seng case tells us about how the court will approach this case because of the peculiarities of the copyright statute. The danger of a permanently inexhaustible class of products simply doesn't exist in the patent field, where it's still based on a first sale. So if the first sale abroad doesn't exhaust patent rights, the first sale here in the U.S. will. But in an attempt to bolster its interpretation of the tension in the statute back in Kurt Seng, the Supreme Court hearkened back to common law. And that's where petitioners in this case have cleverly found support for their argument that Kurt Seng does inform Impression Products. The court quoted a 1623 British legal scholar named Coke that a law that permits a copyright holder to control the resale or other disposition of a chattel once sold is similarly against trade and traffic and bargaining and contracting. However, the court just a few pages earlier in that same Kurt Seng decision where they quoted that passage acknowledged that the Copyright Act was specifically written to permit licenses, and that by their terms, permit licenses that, by their terms, prevent application of the first sale doctrine. That is, if you're only a licensee of a particular copy, you're not an owner of that copy, and so you're not subject to partake of the first sale doctrine. That's an absolutely fair distinction today, and it's one that comes up fairly often. But Coke wrote in 1623, which was a mere 14 years after the enactment of the Statute of Anne, the world's first copyright act, 167 years before the first U.S. Federal Copyright Act, and 355 years before the 1976 Copyright Act that the Supreme Court was reviewing in the Kurt Seng case. So it seems to me it might be a stretch to suppose that Koch's wording was so precise at such an early time in the history of copyright as to anticipate the difference between a license and ownership. And if indeed it didn't, then the court citing to him contradicts its own acknowledgement that the Copyright Act is designed to allow for licenses that do indeed limit the application of the first sale doctrine. So just concluding my opening remarks, I'll note that Kurt Seng was a 6-3 decision with Scalia dissenting. So if you believe that if it was just a pure policy-driven case that the justices wanted international exhaustion, then there are still 6 votes for international exhaustion. However, if you believe that the particulars of the Copyright Act and the concern about a permanently inexhaustible distribution right played a significant part of at least some of the justices' analysis, and I think that Justice Kagan's concurrence suggests that she and Alito did in fact have those concerns, then I think Kurt Seng actually tells us very little about how the court will rule here. So I'll wrap it up there, and I think we can open up for questions. Thank you.
Great, Steve. Thank you. And thank you to all the panelists. Before we open it up to questions from the floor, I wanted to give David a chance. It sounded like you had a couple other things to say about international issues, or perhaps after hearing Adam and Steve talk, you had a couple of extra thoughts. So since you went first, I'll also give you the last word.
Thank you, Kristen. Yeah, I think it is worth teasing out a bit more the differences for the international exhaustion issue, because patent law is particularly different than copyright law in that respect. So in copyright law under the Berne Convention, which now has 102 signatory countries, so basically every country, record something, then it automatically has copyright status in every country. And so a sale in anywhere in the world is a sale that, if it's by the copyright owner, is a sale of the same copyrighted good. Patent law is really different, right? Patent law is territorial. So if you want a patent right in the U.S., you have to file in the U.S. If you want in Germany, you have to file in Germany. If you want in Thailand, you have to file in Thailand. So a sale of a product that's patented in the U.S. may not be patented where else it's sold. And it also, even if it is patented somewhere else, the patent scope may be different depending on the laws and interpretations of that country. So for those reasons, it's really different than Kurtzsang. And I agree with Steve that, or I would go with the, Kurtzsang shouldn't control here. And also I want to say a word about the kind of in favor of facilitating price discrimination, basically, by enforcing the patent laws it's written and saying that there's a right to control importation. So if we think of a patented drug maker who wants to sell or even give away drugs in some place like, say, Somalia, if they do that, that's great. And if we have a law that says there's international exhaustion as soon as there's a sale by the owner who owns a patent in the U.S., and therefore those drugs could be re-imported, the obvious result would be that those drugs wouldn't get sold or they wouldn't get given away in Somalia. And that's pretty pernicious, I think. So it's a pretty pernicious outcome. And likewise, even in the U.S. with the cartridge sales, there's a lot to be said in favor of price discrimination, which, since it has the term or the word discrimination in it, often gets a bad rap. But allowing a cartridge maker or a computer printer maker to kind of price discriminate can allow lots of beneficial things. One of them is metering, so that if someone only values the printer a little bit because they don't use it a lot and they're not going to use a lot of toner cartridges, then allowing them to either pay less by using the returnable cartridge, or maybe you charge more for the cartridges and make sure that they have to be bought from you, that allows you to charge high-value users more but still sell to lower-value users at less. And there's also, advantages as far as you can basically have financing schemes or even risk-sharing schemes through this sort of downstream restrictions. So there's all sorts of productive and commercially valuable arrangements that can be made, but only if there's this ability to control this downstream or field of use or geographic territorial kind of restrictions. So I don't want to go on too long about that, but I would say that both the policy reasons and the very big difference between patent statute and copyright statute should augur for a different outcome here.
Great. Thank you, David. I'm sorry?
Sorry, it's Steve.
Yeah, please answer.
I agree with David that the particulars of the U.S. copyright statute are significant enough, and it's a unique situation that Kurtzsang should not control in impression products versus Lexmark. I do, and maybe this is academic, but a couple of things David said about how the international copyright system works, I think I would see a little differently, and I just wanted to comment on that. The Berne Convention is certainly the leading substantive copyright instrument, and they're up to actually 172 contracting parties, so it is a good portion of the world. But copyright law remains territorial. U.S. copyright law applies in the United States, Thai copyright law applies in Thailand, and so on and so forth. The Berne Convention does provide an obligation to provide national treatment, that is, equal protection to foreign authors as to domestic authors, for authors of other Berne members. But that doesn't mean that copyright law is a global law. It means that U.S. authors can get copyright protection in Thailand. And it's certainly true that arises generally by operation of law as opposed to having to go file patents in different jurisdictions. That's a difference between the nature of how the rights arise between copyright and patent generally, and that's true in the United States too. Thanks.
Great. Thank you. I'm going to turn it over now to Laura, who will open the floor for questions from the listeners.
Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any questions. Kristen, do you have any questions for our panelists?
I actually do. I know Adam submitted an amicus brief in this case, and I know that some other commentators point to the 1952 Act, referring to patents as personal property, and I wondered if Adam had any thoughts about those commentators' arguments or otherwise.
Oh, thanks, Kristen. And that's a great question because that language in the 1952 Act has, I think, created some confusion, and it's also been exploited by some commentators and lawyers today to invoke a language similar to that, like quoted by Steve earlier from Lord Cook in the 17th century about the prohibition on restrictions on chattels, on personal property, which is a longstanding rule in common law. So a lot of people say patent owners can't do this because there's a longstanding rule at common law as applied to patents that you can't impose restrictions on chattels. But that's actually a very anachronistic argument and does not reflect the actual facts of the historical doctrine as it's evolved in the 19th century. I spent a lot of time studying the doctrines of the 19th century. I published three articles on conveyance doctrines of the 19th century as they were understood as a result of my reading all of the published court opinions at that time. And so as a preliminary matter, I can say that the 1952 Act, for the very first time in the patent statutes, codified that patents are property rights. So the patent statutes never explicitly stated that. What they did was they just secured the classic set of property rights, the acquisition, use, enjoyment, disposal, and then that was on the basis of that the courts then said that these are property rights and treated them as such. And from this developed, in this, as I said, a whole assortment of doctrines and translated into patent law, a whole assortment of doctrines from primarily real estate law. In fact, in one case involving a very complicated set of licenses and sub-licenses that just Chief Justice Story had to adjudicate in the 1840s, in which one of the licenses was not recorded per the requirement in the statute act at the time, he invoked classic cases of equity involving real property and even quoted the classic requirement from real estate doctrine that there has to, that although you have to have enfeoffment of livery of season for a valid conveyance of a property interest, equity courts have actually enforced conveyances of property interest when you lacked a fiefment of livery of season, and he upheld the various conveyances in that case. And so what they were trying to achieve in the 1952 Act was simply just codifying this very longstanding judge-made doctrine that explicitly said that these are property interests. Unfortunately, they put the term personal property because it's not attached to a piece of land. But in the legislative history, there is explicit statements to the committee and by participants at the time that I found and reported on one of my articles, where they said, this is not understood to be abrogating this doctrine. This is meant to be a codification of existing judge-made doctrine that has often treated patents as having characteristics that share both elements of real property as well as personal property, and we're not saying all of the property doctrines being thrown, the elements of real estate property are being thrown out, because if they were saying that, they were going to be throwing out a significant portion of patent jurisprudence that was controlling at that time, and they clearly did not intend or want to create that much uncertainty and upend the patent system in that way when the 1952 Patent Act was created. And so what this means is that commentators today who invoke this kind of classic longstanding common law rule, which is true that courts traditionally do not enforce restrictions or servitudes on chattels and apply that to patents are doing so on the basis of, you know, reading the 1952 Patent Act in a way that does not reflect actually what happened in the actual historical doctrine. But then they also then take out of context Supreme Court cases in the 19th century, in which the court did strike down patent owners' abilities to enforce restricted conditions against downstream purchasers or users of their patents, because they failed one of the two primary conditions that I just identified in my opening remarks, which is that the condition has to either be expressly provided in writing or there has to be notice. And of course, that's why these were Supreme Court cases, is because the Supreme Court was taking these cases to essentially enforce these rules against patent owners who were engaging in bad behavior and trying to enforce their patent owner rights under conditions in which the interests would not run with the property interest that was being transferred, because there was either no writing to transfer it, or it was no notice to the downstream successors and assigns.
Oh, great. Thank you, Adam. That was super helpful. Laura, do we have any questions from the listeners?
We do. So I'll go to that first question now. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, this is Trevor Copeland in Chicago. I'm curious what the panelists think about a set of circumstances where I think it would be reasonable for a patentee to use this. Take, for example, a luxury purse manufacturer who has design and utility patents on her purses and who only sells them to high-end retailers where the master sales agreement, or we'll call it a master inventory transfer agreement, specifically limits pricing and retail outlets. In other words, you can only sell these at Macy's and Nordstrom's. You can't sell them at Costco and Sam's Club and Walmart and Family Dollar stores. I'm curious whether this is going to give rise, because of a lack of public sympathy to a patentee being able to profit, if that would actually give rise to genuine antitrust concerns, or if this is the type of patentee rights preservation under a limited term that Adam in particular had been advocating.
This is David. I'm happy to talk a little bit about the antitrust aspects, and then Adam, since your name was invoked, maybe you want to weigh in as well. But Trevor, that's a great question. Thank you for that. And it raises a couple of interesting issues we haven't talked about yet, which is patent misuse and also antitrust law. So in this case, where you have a luxury purse maker who is saying, all right, if you're going to retail my purses, which are covered by patent law, then you have to do so. I don't know. I think you said resale price restrictions, as well as, you know, where they could be retailed. And I assume there'd be I don't know if it goes through a wholesaler who would then sell it to retailers, but be limited to kind of some sort of formulation of high-end retailers, or it's going directly to retailers and they're told they can't resell, except, you know, they can only sell directly to consumers and not resell to other retailers. But anyway, there's various ways that could be set up, and it does raise issues that sound like antitrust issues, and where antitrust law could apply. So antitrust law had for many, many years said you can't, a manufacturer cannot set a price at which their good is going to be resold. And then in the Ligon case in 2007, the Supreme Court finally said, you know what, this was foolish of us all these years. We understand the economic critique of our prior opinions, and it's actually okay for a manufacturer to set resale prices, so long as it's not done in some sort of way that otherwise allows, you know, horizontal price fixing or, you know, across manufacturers or something. So under that case law, that's now dealt with under the rule of reason. Likewise, restricting, you know, exclusive dealings with, you know, only these retailers can sell our products under antitrust law is also dealt with under the rule of reason. And the antitrust law has had, you know, a century plus of cases and really worked through the issues in a lot of detail. And as I argue in an article I have on patent misuse and copyright misuse, I think that's the right place for the analysis to take place. and to read those kinds of antitrust issues into trying to decide patent exhaustion, I think would really complicate the issues and be mistaken. And it's not necessary because there's no protection that a patent gives against the general antitrust analysis. So antitrust law, I think, is the right way to do that. And in the article I wrote about patent misuse, I basically show that it traces, you know, its history from antitrust doctrine, but then what the Federal Circuit and Supreme Court would do sometimes is short-circuit that doctrine and kind of come up with rules that seem to stick for a while, even as antitrust law continued to evolve. So my general argument is that a separate doctrine of patent misuse and copyright misuse, at least for the most part, is ill-founded and is a bad idea. So that also, I think, can lead to more comfort in allowing the kind of, just from a policy perspective, the kind of post-sale restrictions and field of use restrictions that Lexmark wants to have here, because if the company does use that in an anti-competitive way, the fact that patent law allows it does nothing to protect the company from liability under antitrust law.
Would anybody else like to comment on this question, or should we go to the next one?
Adam, did you want to weigh in?
No, David, I think you gave a very effective and thorough answer, so I've got nothing better to add. So thank you. Next question.
Go ahead, caller.
Hello, you may be on mute. Caller.
Hello, Matthew Anderson here. My question was about the contract terms in Bowman v. Monsanto. I think that they were restricting along the same lines, and I was wondering, they were upheld at the Federal Circuit, I believe, if I don't remember incorrectly, and do you think that will weigh in on this case?
Would anybody like to take that question?
I actually did a courthouse steps teleforum on the Bowman v. Monsanto oral argument, and then I did a teleforum when the decision came down, so I'm happy to quickly answer it. In Bowman v. Monsanto, it was patented on a genetically modified seed, and of course the concern there is that farmers will keep the seeds that now are naturally produced by the plant when they grow it, and will replant it, and thus destroy the ability of the biotech company like Monsanto in recouping their R&D, the millions of dollars that they invested to produce that genetically modified crop, and thus their inability to then produce more innovation. And so those companies impose field of use restrictions, so they say you can only use these seeds once, and that was essentially the dispute. There were a lot of kind of side arguments raised in that case about, seeds, you know, can blow sometimes onto other people's property and things of that sort, but that really wasn't an issue in this case because they were soy seeds, and those don't blow. Those were very big and heavy, and it was even a joke made during the argument that maybe a hurricane could blow the seeds, but that's not going to be a common occurrence. The Supreme Court unanimously upheld that type of field of use restriction on genetically modified seeds because it was presented very dramatically by the attorney representing Monsanto with the economic disaster that would result if biotech researchers in the biosciences could not impose those types of restrictions. Surprisingly, that decision will not have an impact in this case, and it was kind of somewhat of a surprising decision. If only it was handed down by, it was written by Justice Breyer, who is not known for being an advocate for patent rights, but it was written by Justice Breyer, and it was for a unanimous court because they expressly and explicitly limited the scope of their decision solely to seeds. so Justice Breyer essentially, from his perspective, because he is a very strong advocate for basically what I would call a per se exhaustion rule for sale of patented and copyrighted works in the market in any context, said that, well, in this case, you can't do this research at all. It's impossible. So we're going to decide just for seeds that they can impose these field of use restrictions. That is clearly very problematic in a lot of levels, because it starts to balkanize what should be a property rights system, because the virtues of property rights systems is it provides the same types of protections for all types of assets, whether it's water or land or books or inventions. You get the same similar types of protections within the context of the nature of the asset being secured and the rights of use and disposal. And so it kind of starts to balkanize the property rights system and convert it more into a subject-specific regulatory type system. But also as a result of that too, the decision will have zero role as precedent for any case because it's limited expressly by its terms to just seeds.
This is David. I think that's exactly right. Just to weigh in on a couple of points, the interesting thing, the economics of it would be that if the case had come out differently, basically Monsanto would have to sell their patented seeds to a farmer once and be done because they could just keep replanting. So the price point would have to, they'd have to say, okay, farmer, go try to get financing or something because we want to sell these seeds to you for $500,000 or something. Which obviously would cause a lot of problems, and I think it's right the case will be kind of limited to the fact that it was it wasn't reselling the same seed or something like that, but it was new seeds that had been produced by growing the sold seeds. But part of the line of thinking of the Bowmans of the world, we're also seeing some in copyright law. There's currently a Second Circuit case pending called Capitol Records versus Redigi, in which the argument is that people should be able to transfer their copyrighted sound recordings, and Redigi has a platform where it's set up so you can be part of the platform, and if you want to transfer or sell your, Britney Spears song to someone, then the platform makes sure that as it's copying the song onto the server, it's deleting it from my computer, and then when the sale happens, it transfers it to the other person's computer and deletes it from the server at Redigi. And what the argument is that effectively this is a transfer of the digital sound recording, even though there's a couple of copies made along the way. I think that the district court said that the copies being made along the way means this is not eligible for first sale, which I think is the right outcome. But it would be interesting if the other kind of position were held sway. Then again, here where you'd have lots of retransfer of, in that case, at least only one kind of copy, even though it's being recopied, the effect on the pricing and marketing approach of these kind of companies could be really different. So these issues really have big economic potential impact, both in patent law and in copyright law.
Great. Let's go ahead and go to our next question.
Hi, good afternoon. So in talking about the Kirtan case, Justice Breyer, in televised interviews and things like that, often described it as one of the most important cases of this century because of the downstream implications. Do you think that this case is going to hold those same that same weightiness as he believes Kirtan to? And if so, do you think we'll expect an opinion from Justice Breyer?
Steve, I think that's a good question for you.
Sure, I'm happy to jump in on that one. Look, Adam already alluded to the fact that Justice Breyer is for per se exhaustion. I think if you look at Justice Breyer's decisions in copyright, with the one exception of the Aereo decision, he's been on the side of less copyright protection in every single decision he's been involved in, as far as I can recall. So I think it's a little bit of an overstatement to say that Kirtan was that important. Maybe he thought so because he was concerned about the inexhaustible downstream doctrine. The reality is when you kind of look under the hood of the Kirtan case, it was a quirk of the statute in the drafting and saying that the importation right was a subset of the distribution right, and then there was a prior Supreme Court case, Quality King versus Lonza, in which the court made clear that, yes, we're applying the first sale doctrine to the importation right. In their concurrences that I alluded to earlier, Justice Kagan, joined by Alito, pointed back to Quality King and said, we realize that our ruling here today essentially eviscerates the importation rule that Congress tried to create in 1976, and it's not our fault because we're bound by Quality King. Quality King said first sales a limitation on import on the importation right. We don't think Congress necessarily intended that, and there's good reason to think that. All of which is to say that I have no doubt that Justice Breyer's vote will be in favor of per se exhaustion. My suspicion is that some of the other justices who were on the Kurtzing decision will not feel as bound in this case because there is no threat of an inexhaustible distribution right that there was in Kurtzing. So I don't think Kurtzing is particularly determinative or even forecast a result in the Lexmark case.
I also just want to step in very quickly just to for a correction. Dave Olson very kindly texted me and said, I think you've got the author of the opinion of Bowman v. Monsanto wrong. It's Kagan, and I double-checked, and it is. It was Justice Kagan. I just remember Justice Breyer because he took a very prominent role in the oral argument in defending the practice, which was a little surprising given the general tenor of his opinions in the IP space, both respect to patents and copyrights. Sorry about that confusion.
Great. Well, we have about 4 minutes left in the teleforum. Would anybody like to make some closing remarks?
This is David. So having said all that we said, I guess maybe it'd be interesting to have predictions. My prediction is I think there will not be a widespread, wide-scale exhaustion holding here. I think particularly internationally, there's good reason to think that it could be treated differently. In the U.S., I'm a little less certain whether the field of use might not be at least limited or maybe even overruled. And I've also found that I'm not particularly good at predicting Supreme Court opinions. So one should bear that in mind as well. But I'd be interested in other opinions.
I agree. I don't think that a per se exhaustion rule is likely here. Whether it will be there's never exhaustion or some sort of qualified where there's been a reservation exhaustion, I'm not going to try and forecast, but I don't think it'll be the full automatic exhaustion rule.
Well, this is David again. I should say that given Quanta and that opinion, I think that to avoid exhaustion, if the court allows exhaustion to be avoided, the court will say that it has to be very explicit and that notice, as Adam said earlier, would have to definitely be at least constructively and maybe actual notice given to kind of the follow-on users or buyers.
And I'll just add that I agree with what David and Steve just said, and I'll also add that one does not have to remain committed even to a property rights perspective of patents to come out in favor of the economic point of the value of price discrimination and how this maximizes overall social welfare by ensuring the more efficient distribution of products and services in the marketplace. And I know this because David and I disagree on some of these foundational questions about the nature of patent rights, but we agree on this, and in fact he and I both joined a brief in favor of the arguing the economic principles in favor of the type of restrictive licensing conditions that are being engaged in by Lexmark and thousands of other patent owners, precisely because that it maximizes overall social welfare and benefits everyone in the long run.
Great. Well, with that, I want to thank our panelists again, David Olson, Adam Mossoff, and Steve Tupp, and I will turn it back to Laura to close out.
Great. Just a reminder that our next Teleform conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Thursday, March 9th. That call will be our last installment in our Security Partnership Teleform series, and we'll discuss foreign government partnerships. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.